The process, according to Hegel, is essential to the understanding of the result. Each later stage of the dialectic contains all the earlier stages, as it were in solution. None of them is wholly superseded, but is given its proper place as a moment in the whole. It is therefore impossible to reach the truth except by going through all the steps of the dialectic. Knowledge as a whole has its triadic movement. It begins with sense perception, in which there is only awareness of the object. Then, through skeptical criticism of the senses, it becomes purely subjective. At last, it reaches the stage of self-knowledge, in which subject and object are no longer distinct. Thus, self-consciousness is the highest form of knowledge. This, of course, must be the case in Hegel's system, for the highest kind of knowledge must be that possessed by the absolute, and as the absolute is the whole, there is nothing outside itself for it to know. In the best thinking, according to Hegel, thoughts become fluent and interfuse. Truth and falsehood are not sharply defined opposites, as is commonly supposed. Nothing is wholly false, and nothing that we can know is wholly true. We can know in a way that is false. This happens when we attribute absolute truth to some detached piece of information. Such a question as, "Where was Caesar born?" has a straightforward answer, which is true in a sense, but not in the philosophical sense. For philosophy, the truth is the whole, and nothing partial is quite true. Reason, Hegel says, is the conscious certainty of being all reality. This does not mean that a separate person is all reality. In his separateness, he is not quite real, but what is real in him is his participation in reality as a whole. In proportion, as we become more rational, this participation is increased. The absolute idea, with which the logic ends, is something like Aristotle's God. It is thought thinking about itself. Clearly, the absolute cannot think about anything but itself, since there is nothing else, except to our partial and erroneous ways of apprehending reality. We are told that spirit is the only reality, and that its thought is reflected into itself by self-consciousness. The actual words in which the absolute idea is defined are very obscure. Wallace translates them as follows. The absolute idea, the idea as unity of the subjective and objective idea, is the notion of the idea, a notion whose object, Gegenstand, is the idea as such, and for which the objective, object, is idea, an object which embraces all characteristics in its unity. The original German is even more difficult. Footnote. The definition in German is der Begriff der Idee, dem die Idee als solche der Gegenstand, dem das Objekt sie ist. Except in Hegel, Gegenstand and object are synonyms. End of footnote. The essence of the matter is, however, somewhat less complicated than Hegel makes it seem. The absolute idea is pure thought, thinking about pure thought. This is all that God does throughout the ages, truly a professor's God. Hegel goes on to say, this unity is consequently the absolute and all truth, the idea which thinks itself. I come now to a singular feature of Hegel's philosophy, which distinguishes it from the philosophy of Plato or Plotinus or Spinoza. Although ultimate reality is timeless, and time is merely an illusion generated by our inability to see the whole, yet the time process has an intimate relation to the purely logical process of the dialectic. World history, in fact, has advanced through the categories from pure being in China, of which Hegel knew nothing except that it was, to the absolute idea, which seems to have been nearly, if not quite, realized in the Prussian state. I cannot see any justification on the basis of his own metaphysic for the view that world history repeats the transitions of the dialectic, yet that is the thesis which he developed in his Philosophy of History. It was an interesting thesis, giving unity and meaning to the revolutions of human affairs. Like other historical theories, it required, if it was to be made plausible, some distortion of facts and considerable ignorance. Hegel, like Marx and Spengler after him, possessed both these qualifications. It is odd that a process which is represented as cosmic should all have taken place on our planet, and most of it near the Mediterranean. Nor is there any reason, if reality is timeless, why the later parts of the process should embody higher categories than the earlier parts, unless one were to adopt the blasphemous supposition that the universe was gradually learning Hegel's philosophy. The time process, according to Hegel, is from the less to the more perfect, both in an ethical and in a logical sense. Indeed, these two senses are, for him, not really distinguishable, for logical perfection consists in being a closely knit whole, without ragged edges, without independent parts, but united like a human body, or still more, like a reasonable mind, into an organism whose parts are interdependent and all work together towards a single end. And this also constitutes ethical perfection. A few quotations will illustrate Hegel's theory. Like the soul conductor, Mercury, the idea is, in truth, the leader of peoples and of the world. And spirit, the rational and necessitated will of that conductor, is and has been the director of the events of the world's history. To become acquainted with spirit, in this, its office of guidance, is the object of our present undertaking. The only thought which philosophy brings with it to the contemplation of history is the simple conception of reason, that reason is the sovereign of the world, that the history of the world, therefore, presents us with a rational process. This conviction and intuition is a hypothesis in the domain of history as such. In that of philosophy, it is no hypothesis. It is there proved by speculative cognition that reason, and this term may here suffice us, without investigating the relation sustained by the universe to the divine being, is substance, as well as infinite power, its own infinite material underlying all the natural and spiritual life which it originates, as also the infinite form, that which sets the material in motion. Reason is the substance of the universe. That this idea or reason is the true, the eternal, the absolutely powerful essence, that it reveals itself in the world, and that in that world nothing else is revealed but this and its honour and glory, is the thesis which, as we have said, has been proved in philosophy and is here regarded as demonstrated. The world of intelligence and conscious volition is not abandoned to chance, but must show itself in the light of the self-cognizant idea. This is a result which happens to be known to me because I have traversed the entire field. All these quotations are from the introduction to The Philosophy of History. Spirit and the course of its development is the substantial object of the philosophy of history. The nature of spirit may be understood by contrasting it with its opposite, namely matter. The essence of matter is gravity. The essence of spirit is freedom. Matter is outside itself, whereas spirit has its center in itself. Spirit is self-contained existence. If this is not clear, the following definition may be found more illuminating. But what is spirit? It is the one immutably homogeneous infinite pure identity, which in its second phase separates itself from itself and makes this second aspect its own polar opposite, namely as existence for and in self as contrasted with the universal. In the historical development of spirit, there have been three main phases: the Orientals, the Greeks and Romans, and the Germans. The history of the world is the discipline of the uncontrolled natural will, bringing it into obedience to a universal principle and conferring subjective freedom. The East knew, and to the present day knows, only that one is free. The Greek and Roman world, that some are free. The German world knows that all are free. One might have supposed that democracy would be the appropriate form of government where all are free, but not so. Democracy and aristocracy alike belong to the stage where some are free, despotism to that where one is free, and monarchy to that in which all are free. This is connected with a very odd sense in which Hegel uses the word freedom. For him, and so far we may agree, there is no freedom without law, but he tends to convert this and to argue that wherever there is law, there is freedom. Thus, freedom for him means little more than the right to obey the law. As might be expected, he assigns the highest role to the Germans in the terrestrial development of spirit. The German spirit is the spirit of the new world. Its aim is the realization of absolute truth as the unlimited self-determination of freedom, that freedom which has its own absolute from itself as its purport. This is a very superfine brand of freedom. It does not mean that you will be able to keep out of a concentration camp. It does not imply democracy or a free press or any of the usual liberal watchwords which Hegel rejects with contempt. Footnote. Freedom of the press, he says, does not consist in being allowed to write what one wants. This view is crude and superficial. For instance, the press should not be allowed to render the government or the police contemptible. End of footnote. When spirit gives laws to itself, it does so freely. To our mundane vision, it may seem that the spirit that gives laws is embodied in the monarch, and the spirit to which laws are given is embodied in his subjects. But from the point of view of the absolute, the distinction between monarch and subjects, like all other distinctions, is illusory, and when the monarch imprisons a liberal-minded subject, that is still spirit freely determining itself. Hegel praises Rousseau for distinguishing between the general will and the will of all. One gathers that the monarch embodies the general will, whereas a parliamentary majority only embodies the will of all, a very convenient doctrine. German history is divided by Hegel into three periods. The first, up to Charlemagne. The second, from Charlemagne to the Reformation. The third, from the Reformation onwards. These three periods are distinguished as the kingdoms of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost, respectively. It seems a little odd that the kingdom of the Holy Ghost should have begun with the bloody and utterly abominable atrocities committed in suppressing the Peasants' War. But Hegel, naturally, does not mention so trivial an incident. Instead, he goes off, as might be expected, into praises of Machiavelli. Hegel's interpretation of history since the fall of the Roman Empire is partly the effect, and partly the cause, of the teaching of world history in German schools. In Italy and France, while there has been a romantic admiration of the Germans on the part of a few men such as Tacitus and Machiavelli, they have been viewed, in general, as the authors of the barbarian invasion, and as enemies of the Church, first under the great emperors, and later as the leaders of the Reformation. Until the 19th century, the Latin nations looked upon the Germans as their inferiors in civilization. Protestants in Germany naturally took a different view. They regarded the late Romans as a feat, and considered the German conquest of the Western Empire an essential step towards revivification. In relation to the conflict of empire and papacy in the Middle Ages, they took a Ghibelline view. To this day, German schoolboys are taught a boundless admiration of Charlemagne and Barbarossa. In the times after the Reformation, the political weakness and disunity of Germany was deplored, and the gradual rise of Prussia was welcomed as making Germany strong under Protestant leadership, not under the Catholic and somewhat feeble leadership of Austria. Hegel, in philosophizing about history, has in mind such men as Theodoric, Charlemagne, Barbarossa, Luther, and Frederick the Great. He is to be interpreted in the light of their exploits, and in the light of the then recent humiliation of Germany by Napoleon. So much is Germany glorified that one might expect to find it the final embodiment of the absolute idea, beyond which no further development would be possible. But this is not Hegel's view. On the contrary, he says that America is the land of the future, where, in the ages that lie before us, the burden of the world's history shall reveal itself, perhaps, he adds characteristically, in a contest between North and South America. He seems to think that everything important takes the form of war. If it were suggested to him that the contribution of America to world history might be the development of a society without extreme poverty, he would not be interested. On the contrary, he says that, as yet, there is no real state in America, because a real state requires a division of classes into rich and poor. Nations, in Hegel, play the part that classes play in Marx. The principle of historical development, he says, is national genius. In every age there is some one nation which is charged with the mission of carrying the world through the stage of the dialectic that it has reached. In our age, of course, this nation is Germany. But in addition to nations, we must also take account of world historical individuals. These are men in whose aims are embodied the dialectical transitions that are due to take place in their time. These men are heroes, and may justifiably contravene ordinary moral rules. Alexander, Caesar and Napoleon are given as examples. I doubt whether, in Hegel's opinion, a man could be a hero without being a military conqueror. Hegel's emphasis on nations, together with his peculiar conception of freedom, explains his glorification of the state, a very important aspect of his political philosophy to which we must now turn our attention. His philosophy of the state is developed both in his philosophy of history and in his philosophy of law. It is in the main compatible with his general metaphysic, but not necessitated by it. At certain points, however, for example, as regards the relation between states, his admiration of the national state is carried so far as to become inconsistent with his general preference of wholes to parts. Glorification of the state begins, so far as modern times are concerned, with the Reformation. In the Roman Empire, the emperor was deified, and the state thereby acquired a sacred character. But the philosophers of the Middle Ages, with few exceptions, were ecclesiastics, and therefore put the church above the state. Luther, finding support in Protestant princes, began the opposite practice. The Lutheran church, on the whole, was Erastian. Hobbes, who was politically a Protestant, developed the doctrine of the supremacy of the state, and Spinoza, on the whole, agreed with him. Rousseau, as we have seen, thought the state should not tolerate other political organizations. Hegel was vehemently Protestant of the Lutheran section. The Prussian state was an Erastian absolute monarchy. These reasons would make one expect to find the state highly valued by Hegel, but even so, he goes to lengths which are astonishing. We are told in the philosophy of history that the state is the actually existing realized moral life, and that all the spiritual reality possessed by a human being he possesses only through the state. For his spiritual reality consists in this, that his own essence, reason, is objectively present to him, that it possesses objective immediate existence for him. For truth is the unity of the universal and subjective will, and the universal is to be found in the state, in its laws, its universal and rational arrangements. The state is the divine idea as it exists on earth. Again, the state is the embodiment of rational freedom, realizing and recognizing itself in an objective form. The state is the idea of spirit in the external manifestation of human will and its freedom. The philosophy of law, in the section on the state, develops the same doctrine somewhat more fully. The state is the reality of the moral idea. The moral spirit, as the visible substantial will, evident to itself, which thinks and knows itself, and fulfills what it knows in so far as it knows it. The state is the rational in and for itself. If the state existed only for the interests of individuals, as liberals contend, an individual might or might not be a member of the state. It has, however, a quite different relation to the individual. Since it is objective spirit, the individual only has objectivity, truth, and morality, in so far as he is a member of the state, whose true content and purpose is union as such. It is admitted that there may be bad states, but these merely exist and have no true reality, whereas a rational state is infinite in itself. It will be seen that Hegel claims for the state much the same position as St. Augustine and his Catholic successors claimed for the Church. There are, however, two respects in which the Catholic claim is more reasonable than Hegel's. In the first place, the Church is not a chance geographical association, but a body united by a common creed, believed by its members to be of supreme importance. It is thus, in its very essence, the embodiment of what Hegel calls the idea. In the second place, there is only one Catholic Church, whereas there are many states. When each state, in relation to its subjects, is made as absolute as Hegel makes it, there is difficulty in finding any philosophical principle by which to regulate the relations between different states. In fact, at this point, Hegel abandons his philosophical talk, falling back on the state of nature and Hobbes's war of all against all. The habit of speaking of the state, as if there were only one, is misleading so long as there is no world state. Duty being, for Hegel, solely a relation of the individual to his state, no principle is left by which to moralize the relations between states. This Hegel recognizes. In external relations, he says, the state is an individual, and each state is independent as against the others. Since in this independence the being for self of real spirit has its existence, it is the first freedom and highest honor of a people. He goes on to argue against any sort of League of Nations by which the independence of separate states might be limited. The duty of a citizen is entirely confined, so far as the external relations of his state are concerned, to upholding the substantial individuality and independence and sovereignty of his own state. It follows that war is not wholly an evil, or something that we should seek to abolish. The purpose of the state is not merely to uphold the life and property of the citizens, and this fact provides the moral justification of war, which is not to be regarded as an absolute evil, or as accidental, or as having its cause in something that ought not to be. Hegel does not mean only that, in some situations, a nation cannot rightly avoid going to war. He means much more than this. He is opposed to the creation of institutions, such as a world government, which would prevent such situations from arising, because he thinks it is a good thing that there should be wars from time to time. War, he says, is the condition in which we take seriously the vanity of temporal goods and things. This view is to be contrasted with the opposite theory that all wars have economic causes. War has a positive moral value. War has the higher significance that through it the moral health of peoples is preserved in their indifference towards the stabilizing of finite determinations. Peace is ossification. The Holy Alliance and Kant's League for Peace are mistaken because a family of states needs an enemy. Conflicts of states can only be decided by war. States being towards each other in a state of nature, their relations are not legal or moral. Their rights have their reality in their particular wills, and the interest of each state is its own highest law. There is no contrast of morals and politics because states are not subject to ordinary moral laws. Such is Hegel's doctrine of the state, a doctrine which, if accepted, justifies every internal tyranny and every external aggression that can possibly be imagined. The strength of his bias appears in the fact that his theory is largely inconsistent with his own metaphysic, and that the inconsistencies are all such as tend to the justification of cruelty and international brigandage. A man may be pardoned if logic compels him regretfully to reach conclusions which he deplores, but not for departing from logic in order to be free to advocate crimes. Hegel's logic led him to believe that there is more reality or excellence, the two for him are synonyms, in wholes than in their parts, and that a whole increases in reality and excellence as it becomes more organized. This justified him in preferring a state to an anarchic collection of individuals, but it should equally have led him to prefer a world state to an anarchic collection of states. Within the state, his general philosophy should have led him to feel more respect for the individual than he did feel. For the wholes of which his logic treats are not like the one of Parmenides or even like Spinoza's God. They are wholes in which the individual does not disappear, but acquires fuller reality through his harmonious relation to a larger organism. A state in which the individual is ignored is not a small-scale model of the Hegelian absolute. Nor is there any good reason in Hegel's metaphysic for the exclusive emphasis on the state as opposed to other social organizations. I can see nothing but Protestant bias in his preference of the state to the church. Moreover, if it is good that society should be as organic as possible, as Hegel believes, then many social organizations are necessary in addition to the state and the church. It should follow from Hegel's principles that every interest which is not harmful to the community and which can be promoted by cooperation should have its appropriate organization, and that every such organization should have its quota of limited independence. It may be objected that ultimate authority must reside somewhere and cannot reside elsewhere than in the state. But even so, it may be desirable that this ultimate authority should not be irresistible when it attempts to be oppressive beyond a point. This brings us to a question which is fundamental in judging Hegel's whole philosophy. Is there more reality and is there more value in a whole than in its parts? Hegel answers both questions in the affirmative. The question of reality is metaphysical. The question of value is ethical. They are commonly treated as if they were scarcely distinguishable, but to my mind it is important to keep them apart. Let us begin with the metaphysical question. The view of Hegel and of many other philosophers is that the character of any portion of the universe is so profoundly affected by its relations to the other parts and to the whole that no true statement can be made about any part except to assign its place in the whole. Since its place in the whole depends upon all the other parts, a true statement about its place in the whole will, at the same time, assign the place of every other part in the whole. Thus, there can be only one true statement. There is no truth except the whole truth. And similarly, nothing is quite real except the whole. For any part, when isolated, is changed in character by being isolated, and therefore no longer appears quite what it truly is. On the other hand, when a part is viewed in relation to the whole, as it should be, it is seen to be not self-subsistent, and to be incapable of existing except as part of just that whole which alone is truly real. This is the metaphysical doctrine. The ethical doctrine, which maintains that value resides in the whole rather than in the parts, must be true if the metaphysical doctrine is true, but need not be false if the metaphysical doctrine is false. It may, moreover, be true of some wholes and not of others. It is obviously true in some sense of a living body. The eye is worthless when separated from the body. A collection of disjecta membra, even when complete, has not the value that once belonged to the body from which they were taken. Hegel conceives the ethical relation of the citizen to the state as analogous to that of the eye to the body. In his place, the citizen is part of a valuable whole, but isolated, he is as useless as an isolated eye. The analogy, however, is open to question. From the ethical importance of some wholes, that of all wholes does not follow. The above statement of the ethical problem is defective in one important respect, namely, that it does not take account of the distinction between ends and means. An eye in a living body is useful, that is to say, it has value as a means. But it has no more intrinsic value than when detached from the body. A thing has intrinsic value when it is prized for its own sake, not as a means to something else. We value the eye as a means to seeing. Seeing may be a means or an end. It is a means when it shows us food or enemies. It is an end when it shows us something that we find beautiful. The state is obviously valuable as a means. It protects us against thieves and murderers. It provides roads and schools and so on. It may, of course, also be bad as a means, for example, by waging an unjust war. The real question we have to ask in connection with Hegel is not this, but whether the state is good per se, as an end. Do the citizens exist for the sake of the state, or the state for the sake of the citizens? Hegel holds the former view. The liberal philosophy that comes from Locke holds the latter. It is clear that we shall only attribute intrinsic value to the state if we think of it as having a life of its own, as being in some sense a person. At this point, Hegel's metaphysic becomes relevant to the question of value. A person is a complex whole, having a single life. Can there be a superperson, composed of persons as the body is composed of organs, and having a single life which is not the sum of the lives of the component persons? If there can be such a superperson, as Hegel thinks, then the state may be such a being, and it may be as superior to ourselves as the whole body is to the eye. But if we think this superperson a mere metaphysical monstrosity, then we shall say that the intrinsic value of a community is derived from that of its members, and that the state is a means, not an end. We are thus brought back from the ethical to the metaphysical question. The metaphysical question itself, we shall find, is really a question of logic. The question at issue is much wider than the truth or falsehood of Hegel's philosophy. It is the question that divides the friends of analysis from its enemies. Let us take an illustration. Suppose I say, John is the father of James. Hegel, and all who believe in what Marshall Smuts calls holism, will say, before you can understand this statement, you must know who John and James are. Now, to know who John is to know all his characteristics, for apart from them he would not be distinguishable from anyone else. But all his characteristics involve other people or things. He is characterized by his relations to his parents, his wife and his children, by whether he is a good or bad citizen, and by the country to which he belongs. All these things you must know before you can be said to know whom the word John refers to. Step by step in your endeavor to say what you mean by the word John, you will be led to take account of the whole universe, and your original statement will turn out to be telling you something about the universe, not about two separate people, John and James. Now, this is all very well, but it is open to an initial objection. If the above argument was sound, how could knowledge ever begin? I know numbers of propositions of the form A is the father of B, but I do not know the whole universe. If all knowledge were knowledge of the universe as a whole, there would be no knowledge. This is enough to make us suspect a mistake somewhere. The fact is that, in order to use the word John correctly and intelligently, I do not need to know all about John, but only enough to recognize him. No doubt he has relations, near or remote, to everything in the universe, but he can be spoken of truly without taking them into account, except such as are the direct subject matter of what is being said. He may be the father of Jemima as well as of James, but it is not necessary for me to know this in order to know that he is the father of James. If Hegel were right, we could not state fully what is meant by John is the father of James without mentioning Jemima. We ought to say, John, the father of Jemima, is the father of James. This would still be inadequate. We should have to go on to mention his parents and grandparents and a whole who's who. But this lands us in absurdities. The Hegelian position might be stated as follows. The word John means all that is true of John. But as a definition, this is circular, since the word John occurs in the defining phrase. In fact, if Hegel were right, no word could begin to have a meaning, since we should need to know already the meanings of all the other words in order to state all the properties of what the word designates, which, according to the theory, are what the word means. To put the matter abstractly, we must distinguish properties of different kinds. A thing may have a property not involving any other thing. This sort is called a quality. Or it may have a property involving one other thing. Such a property is being married. Or it may have one involving two other things, such as being a brother-in-law. If a certain thing has a certain collection of qualities, and no other thing has just this collection of qualities, then it can be defined as the thing having such and such qualities. From its having these qualities, nothing can be deduced by pure logic as to its relational properties. Hegel thought that if enough was known about a thing to distinguish it from all other things, then all its properties could be inferred by logic. This was a mistake, and from this mistake arose the whole imposing edifice of his system. This illustrates an important truth, namely, that the worse your logic, the more interesting the consequences to which it gives rise. Chapter 23. Byron. The 19th century, in comparison with the present age, appears rational, progressive, and satisfied. Yet the opposite qualities of our time were possessed by many of the most remarkable men during the epoch of liberal optimism. When we consider men, not as artists or discoverers, not as sympathetic or antipathetic to our own tastes, but as forces, as causes of change in the social structure, in judgments of value, or in intellectual outlook, we find that the course of events in recent times has necessitated much readjustment in our estimates, making some men less important than they had seemed, and others more so. Among those whose importance is greater than it seemed, Byron deserves a high place. On the continent, such a view would not appear surprising, but in the English-speaking world it may be thought strange. It was on the continent that Byron was influential, and it is not in England that his spiritual progeny is to be sought. To most of us, his verse seems often poor, and his sentiment often tawdry, but abroad his way of feeling and his outlook on life were transmitted and developed and transmuted until they became so widespread as to be factors in great events. The aristocratic rebel, of whom Byron was in his day the exemplar, is a very different type from the leader of a peasant or proletarian revolt. Those who are hungry have no need of an elaborate philosophy to stimulate or excuse discontent, and anything of the kind appears to them merely an amusement of the idle rich. They want what others have, not some intangible and metaphysical good. Though they may preach Christian love, as the medieval communist rebels did, their real reasons for doing so are very simple: that the lack of it in the rich and powerful causes the sufferings of the poor, and that the presence of it among comrades in revolt is thought essential to success. But the experience of the struggle leads to a despair of the power of love, leaving naked hate as the driving force. A rebel of this type, if like Marx, he invents a philosophy, invents one solely designed to demonstrate the ultimate victory of his party, not one concerned with values. His values remain primitive. The good is enough to eat, the rest is talk. No hungry man is likely to think otherwise. The aristocratic rebel, since he has enough to eat, must have other causes of discontent. I do not include among rebels the mere leaders of factions temporarily out of power. I include only men whose philosophy requires some greater change than their own personal success. It may be that love of power is the underground source of their discontent. But in their conscious thought, there is criticism of the government of the world, which, when it goes deep enough, takes the form of titanic cosmic self-assertion, or, in those who retain some superstition, of Satanism. Both are to be found in Byron. Both, largely through men whom he influenced, became common in large sections of society which could hardly be deemed aristocratic. The aristocratic philosophy of rebellion, growing, developing, and changing as it approached maturity, has inspired a long series of revolutionary movements, from the Carbonari after the fall of Napoleon to Hitler's coup in 1933, and at each stage it has inspired a corresponding manner of thought and feeling among intellectuals and artists. It is obvious that an aristocrat does not become a rebel unless his temperament and circumstances are in some way peculiar. Byron's circumstances were very peculiar. His earliest recollections were of his parents' quarrels. His mother was a woman whom he feared for her cruelty and despised for her vulgarity. His nurse combined wickedness with the strictest Calvinist theology. His lameness filled him with shame and prevented him from being one of the herd at school. At 10 years old, after living in poverty, he suddenly found himself a lord and the owner of Newstead. His great uncle, the wicked lord from whom he inherited, had killed a man in a duel 33 years ago and been ostracized by his neighbors ever since. The Byrons had been a lawless family, and the Gordons, his mother's ancestors, even more so. After the squalor of a back street in Aberdeen, the boy naturally rejoiced in his title and his abbey, and was willing to take on the character of his ancestors in gratitude for their lands. And if, in recent years, their bellicosity had led them into trouble, he learnt that in former centuries it had brought them renown. One of his earliest poems, On Leaving Newstead Abbey, relates his emotions at this time, which are of admiration for his ancestors who fought in the Crusades, at Crecy and at Marston Moor. He ends with the pious resolve, "Like you will he live, or like you will he perish. When decayed, may he mingle his dust with your own." This is not the mood of a rebel, but it suggests Childe Harold, the modern peer who imitates medieval barons. As an undergraduate, when for the first time he had an income of his own, he wrote that he felt as independent as a German prince who coins his own cash, or a Cherokee chief who coins no cash at all, but enjoys what is more precious, liberty. "I speak in raptures of that goddess because my amiable mamma was so despotic." He wrote, in later life, much noble verse in praise of freedom. But it must be understood that the freedom he praised was that of a German prince or a Cherokee chief, not the inferior sort that might conceivably be enjoyed by ordinary mortals. In spite of his lineage and his title, his aristocratic relations fought shy of him, and he was made to feel himself socially not of their society. His mother was intensely disliked, and he was looked on with suspicion. He knew that she was vulgar, and darkly feared a similar defect in himself. Hence arose that peculiar blend of snobbery and rebellion that characterized him. If he could not be a gentleman in the modern style, he would be a bold baron in the style of his crusading ancestors, or perhaps in the more ferocious but even more romantic style of the Ghibelline chiefs, cursed of god and man as they trampled their way to splendid downfall. Medieval romances and histories were his etiquette books. He sinned like the Hohenstaufen, and like the Crusaders, he died fighting the Muslim. His shyness and sense of friendlessness made him look for comfort in love affairs, but as he was unconsciously seeking a mother rather than a mistress, all disappointed him except Augusta. Calvinism, which he never shook off, to Shelley in 1816 he described himself as Methodist, Calvinist, Augustinian, made him feel that his manner of life was wicked. But wickedness, he told himself, was a hereditary curse in his blood, an evil fate to which he was predestined by the Almighty. If that were indeed the case, since he must be remarkable, he would be remarkable as a sinner, and would dare transgressions beyond the courage of the fashionable libertines whom he wished to despise. He loved Augusta genuinely because she was of his blood, of the Ishmaelite race of the Byrons, and also, more simply, because she had an elder sister's kindly care for his daily welfare. But this was not all that she had to offer him. Through her simplicity and her obliging good nature, she became the means of providing him with the most delicious self-congratulatory remorse. He could feel himself the equal of the greatest sinners, the peer of Manfred, of Cain, almost of Satan himself. The Calvinist, the aristocrat, and the rebel were all equally satisfied, and so was the romantic lover, whose heart was broken by the loss of the only earthly being still capable of rousing in it the gentler emotions of pity and love. Byron, though he felt himself the equal of Satan, never quite ventured to put himself in the place of God. This next step in the growth of pride was taken by Nietzsche, who says, "If there were gods, how could I endure it to be not God? Therefore, there are no gods." Observe the suppressed premise of this reasoning. Whatever humbles my pride is to be judged false. Nietzsche, like Byron, and even to a greater degree, had a pious upbringing. But having a better intellect, he found a better escape than Satanism. He remained, however, very sympathetic to Byron. He says, "The tragedy is that we cannot believe the dogmas of religion and metaphysics if we have the strict methods of truth in heart and head. But on the other hand, we have become, through the development of humanity, so tenderly, sensitively suffering that we need the highest kind of means of salvation and consolation. Whence arises the danger that man may bleed to death through the truth that he recognizes." Byron expresses this in immortal lines. "Sorrow is knowledge. They who know the most must mourn the deepest o'er the fatal truth. The tree of knowledge is not that of life." Sometimes, though rarely, Byron approaches more nearly to Nietzsche's point of view, but in general Byron's ethical theory, as opposed to his practice, remains strictly conventional. The great man to Nietzsche is godlike, to Byron usually a titan at war with himself. Sometimes, however, he portrays a sage, not unlike Zarathustra, the corsair in his dealings with his followers, still sways their souls with that commanding art that dazzles, leads, yet chills the vulgar heart. And this same hero hated man too much to feel remorse. A footnote assures us that the corsair is true to human nature, since similar traits were exhibited by Genseric, king of the Vandals, by Ezzelino, the Ghibelline tyrant, and by a certain Louisiana pirate. Byron was not obliged to confine himself to the Levant and the Middle Ages in his search for heroes, since it was not difficult to invest Napoleon with a romantic mantle. The influence of Napoleon on the imagination of 19th century Europe was very profound. He inspired Clausewitz, Stendhal, Heine, the thought of Fichte and Nietzsche, and the acts of Italian patriots. His ghost stalks through the age, the only force which is strong enough to stand up against industrialism and commerce, pouring scorn on pacifism and shopkeeping. Tolstoy's War and Peace is an attempt to exorcise the ghost, but a vain one, for the spectre has never been more powerful than at the present day. During the Hundred Days, Byron proclaimed his wish for Napoleon's victory, and when he heard of Waterloo, he said, "I'm damned sorry for it." Only once for a moment did he turn against his hero, in 1814, when, so he thought, suicide would have been more seemly than abdication. At this moment he sought consolation in the virtue of Washington, but the return from Elba made this effort no longer necessary. In France, when Byron died, it was remarked in many newspapers that the two greatest men of the century, Napoleon and Byron, had disappeared almost at the same time. Carlyle, who at the time considered Byron the noblest spirit in Europe and felt as if he had lost a brother, came afterwards to prefer Goethe, but he still coupled Byron with Napoleon. For your nobler minds, the publishing of some such work of art in one or the other dialect becomes almost a necessity. For what is it, properly, but an altercation with the devil before you begin honestly fighting him? Your Byron publishes his Sorrows of Lord George in verse and in prose, and copiously otherwise. Your Bonaparte presents his Sorrows of Napoleon opera in an all-too-stupendous style, with music of cannon volleys and murder shrieks of a world. His stage lights are the fires of conflagration, his rhyme and recitative are the tramp of embattled hosts and the sound of falling cities. It is true that three chapters further on, he gives the emphatic command, "Close thy Byron, open thy Goethe," but Byron was in his blood, whereas Goethe remained an aspiration. To Carlyle, Goethe and Byron were antitheses. To Alfred de Musset, they were accomplices in the wicked work of instilling the poison of melancholy into the cheerful Gallic soul. Most young Frenchmen of that age knew Goethe, it seems, only through the Sorrows of Werther, and not at all as the Olympian. Musset blamed Byron for not being consoled by the Adriatic and the Countess Guiccioli, wrongly, for after he knew her, he wrote no more Manfreds. But Don Juan was as little read in France as Goethe's most cheerful poetry. In spite of Musset, most French poets ever since have found Byronic unhappiness the best material for their verses. To Musset, it was only after Napoleon that Byron and Goethe were the greatest geniuses of the century. Born in 1810, Musset was one of the generation whom he describes as conçu entre deux batailles, in a lyrical description of the glories and disasters of the empire. In Germany, feeling about Napoleon was more divided. There were those who, like Heine, saw him as the mighty missionary of liberalism, the destroyer of serfdom, the enemy of legitimacy, the man who made hereditary princelings tremble. There were others who saw him as Antichrist, the would-be destroyer of the noble German nation, the immoralist who had proved once for all that Teutonic virtue can only be preserved by unquenchable hatred of France. Bismarck,
but extremely logical in a manner.
Napoleon remained Antichrist, but an Antichrist to be imitated, not merely to be abhorred. Nietzsche, who accepted the compromise, remarked with ghoulish joy that the classical age of war is coming, and that we owe this boon not to the French Revolution, but to Napoleon. And in this way, nationalism, Satanism, and hero worship, the legacy of Byron, became part of the complex soul of Germany. Byron is not gentle, but violent like a thunderstorm. What he says of Rousseau is applicable to himself. Rousseau was, he says, he who threw enchantment over passion, and from woe wrung overwhelming eloquence. Yet he knew how to make madness beautiful, and cast o'er erring deeds and thoughts a heavenly hue. But there is a profound difference between the two men. Rousseau is pathetic, Byron is fierce. Rousseau's timidity is obvious, Byron's is concealed. Rousseau admires virtue, provided it is simple, while Byron admires sin, provided it is elemental. The difference, though it is only that between two stages in the revolt of unsocial instincts, is important, and shows the direction in which the movement is developing. Byron's romanticism, it must be confessed, was only half sincere. At times he would say that Pope's poetry was better than his own, but this judgment also was probably only what he thought in certain moods. The world insisted on simplifying him, and omitting the element of pose in his cosmic despair, and professed contempt for mankind. Like many other prominent men, he was more important as a myth than as he really was. As a myth, his importance, especially on the continent, was enormous. Chapter 24. Schopenhauer. Schopenhauer, 1788-1860, is in many ways peculiar among philosophers. He is a pessimist, whereas almost all the others are in some sense optimists. He is not fully academic, like Kant and Hegel, nor yet completely outside the academic tradition. He dislikes Christianity, preferring the religions of India, both Hinduism and Buddhism. He is a man of wide culture, quite as much interested in art as in ethics. He is unusually free from nationalism, and as much at home with English and French writers as with those of his own country. His appeal has always been less to professional philosophers than to artistic and literary people in search of a philosophy that they could believe. He began the emphasis on will, which is characteristic of much 19th and 20th century philosophy. But for him, will, though metaphysically fundamental, is ethically evil, an opposition only possible for a pessimist. He acknowledges three sources of his philosophy: Kant, Plato, and the Upanishads. But I do not think he owes as much to Plato as he thinks he does. His outlook has a certain temperamental affinity with that of the Hellenistic age. It is tired and valetudinarian, valuing peace more than victory, and quietism more than attempts at reform, which he regards as inevitably futile. Both his parents belonged to prominent commercial families in Danzig, where he was born. His father was a Voltairean, who regarded England as the land of liberty and intelligence. In common with most of the leading citizens of Danzig, he hated the encroachments of Prussia on the independence of the free city, and was indignant when it was annexed to Prussia in 1793, so indignant that he removed to Hamburg at considerable pecuniary loss. Schopenhauer lived there with his father from 1793 to 1797. Then he spent 2 years in Paris, at the end of which his father was pleased to find that the boy had nearly forgotten German. In 1803, he was put in a boarding school in England, where he hated the cant and hypocrisy. 2 years later, to please his father, he became a clerk in a commercial house in Hamburg, but he loathed the prospect of a business career and longed for a literary and academic life. This was made possible by his father's death, probably by suicide. His mother was willing that he should abandon commerce for school and university. It might be supposed that he would, in consequence, have preferred her to his father, but the exact opposite happened. He disliked his mother and retained an affectionate memory of his father. Schopenhauer's mother was a lady of literary aspirations who settled in Weimar 2 weeks before the Battle of Jena.
Went to Cherbourg for a week.
Every salon, wrote books and enjoyed friendships with men of culture. She had little affection for her son and a keen eye for his faults. She warned him against bombast and empty pathos. He was annoyed by her philanderings. When he came of age, he inherited a modest competence. After this, he and his mother gradually found each other more and more intolerable. His low opinion of women is no doubt due, at least in part, to his quarrels with his mother. Already at Hamburg, he had come under the influence of the Romantics, especially Tieck, Novalis, and Hoffmann, from whom he learnt to admire Greece and to think ill of the Hebraic elements in Christianity. Another Romantic, Friedrich Schlegel, confirmed him in his admiration of Indian philosophy. In the year in which he came of age, 1809, he went to the University of Göttingen, where he learnt to admire Kant. 2 years later, he went to Berlin, where he studied mainly science. He heard Fichte lecture, but despised him. He remained indifferent throughout the excitement of the War of Liberation. In 1819, he became a Privatdozent at Berlin, and had the conceit to put his lectures at the same hour as Hegel's. Having failed to lure away Hegel's hearers, he soon ceased to lecture. In the end, he settled down to the life of an old bachelor in Dresden. He kept a poodle named Atma, the world soul, walked 2 hours every day, smoked a long pipe, read the London Times, and employed correspondents to hunt up evidences of his fame. He was anti-democratic and hated the revolution of 1848. He believed in spiritualism and magic. In his study, he had a bust of Kant and a bronze Buddha. In his manner of life, he tried to imitate Kant, except as regards early rising. His principal work, The World as Will and Idea, was published at the end of 1818. He believed it to be of great importance, and went so far as to say that some paragraphs in it had been dictated by the Holy Ghost. To his great mortification, it fell completely flat. In 1844, he persuaded the publisher to bring out a second edition, but it was not till some years later that he began to receive some of the recognition for which he longed. Schopenhauer's system is an adaptation of Kant's, but one that emphasizes quite different aspects of the critique from those emphasized by Fichte or Hegel. They got rid of the thing in itself, and thus made knowledge metaphysically fundamental. Schopenhauer retained the thing in itself, but identified it with will. He held that what appears to perception as my body is really my will. There was more to be said for this view as a development of Kant than most Kantians were willing to recognize. Kant had maintained that a study of the moral law can take us behind phenomena and give us knowledge which sense perception cannot give. He also maintained that the moral law is essentially concerned with the will. The difference between a good man and a bad man is, for Kant, a difference in the world of things in themselves, and is also a difference as to volitions. It follows that, for Kant, volitions must belong to the real world, not to the world of phenomena. The phenomenon corresponding to a volition is a bodily movement. That is why, according to Schopenhauer, the body is the appearance of which will is the reality. But the will which is behind phenomena cannot consist of a number of different volitions. Both time and space, according to Kant, and in this Schopenhauer agrees with him, belong only to phenomena. The thing in itself is not in space or time. My will, therefore, in the sense in which it is real, cannot be dated, nor can it be composed of separate acts of will, because it is space and time that are the source of plurality, the principle of individuation, to use the scholastic phrase which Schopenhauer prefers. My will, therefore, is one and timeless. Nay, more, it is to be identified with the will of the whole universe. My separateness is an illusion, resulting from my subjective apparatus of spatio-temporal perception. What is real is one vast will, appearing in the whole course of nature, animate and inanimate alike. So far, we might expect Schopenhauer to identify his cosmic will with God, and teach a pantheistic doctrine, not unlike Spinoza's, in which virtue would consist in conformity to the divine will. But at this point, his pessimism leads to a different development. The cosmic will is wicked. Will altogether is wicked, or at any rate is the source of all our endless suffering. Suffering is essential to all life, and is increased by every increase of knowledge. Will has no fixed end, which, if achieved, would bring contentment. Although death must conquer in the end, we pursue our futile purposes. As we blow out a soap bubble, as long and as large as possible, although we know perfectly well that it will burst. There is no such thing as happiness, for an unfulfilled wish causes pain, and attainment brings only satiety. Instinct urges men to procreation, which brings into existence a new occasion for suffering and death. That is why shame is associated with a sexual act. Suicide is useless. The doctrine of transmigration, even if not literally true, conveys truth in the form of a myth. All this is very sad, but there is a way out, and it was discovered in India. The best of myths is that of Nirvana, which Schopenhauer interprets as extinction. This, he agrees, is contrary to Christian doctrine, but the ancient wisdom of the human race will not be displaced by what happened in Galilee. The cause of suffering is intensity of will. The less we exercise will, the less we shall suffer. And here, knowledge turns out to be useful after all, provided it is knowledge of a certain sort. The distinction between one man and another is part of the phenomenal world, and disappears when the world is seen truly. To the good man, the veil of Maya, illusion, has become transparent. He sees that all things are one, and that the distinction between himself and another is only apparent. He reaches this insight by love, which is always sympathy and has to do with the pain of others. When the veil of Maya is lifted, a man takes on the suffering of the whole world. In the good man, knowledge of the whole quiets all volition. His will turns away from life and denies his own nature. There arises within him a horror of the nature of which his own phenomenal existence is an expression, the kernel and inner nature of that world which is recognized as full of misery. Hence, Schopenhauer is led to complete agreement, at least as regards practice, with ascetic mysticism. Eckhart and Angelus Silesius are better than the New Testament. There are some good things in Orthodox Christianity, notably the doctrine of original sin as preached against the vulgar Pelagianism by St. Augustine and Luther. But the Gospels are sadly deficient in metaphysics. Buddhism, he says, is the highest religion, and his ethical doctrines are orthodox throughout Asia, except where the detestable doctrine of Islam prevails. The good man will practice complete chastity, voluntary poverty, fasting, and self-torture. In all things, he will aim at breaking down his individual will. But he does not do this, as do the Western mystics, to achieve harmony with God. No such positive good is sought. The good that is sought is wholly and entirely negative. We must banish the dark impression of that nothingness which we discern behind all virtue and holiness as their final goal, and which we fear as children fear the dark. We must not even evade it, like the Indians, through myths and meaningless words, such as reabsorption in Brahma or the Nirvana of the Buddhists. Rather, do we freely acknowledge that what remains after the entire abolition of will is for all those who are still full of will, certainly nothing. But conversely, to those in whom the will has turned and has denied itself, this our world, which is so real, with all its suns and milky ways, is nothing. There is a vague suggestion here that the saint sees something positive which other men do not see, but there is nowhere a hint as to what this is, and I think the suggestion is only rhetorical. The world and all its phenomena, Schopenhauer says, are only the objectification of will. With the surrender of the will, all those phenomena are also abolished. That constant strain and effort without end and without rest at all the grades of objectivity, in which and through which the world consists, the multifarious forms succeeding each other in gradation, the whole manifestation of the will, and finally also the universal forms of this manifestation, time and space, and also its last fundamental form, subject and object, all are abolished. No will, no idea, no world. Before us there is certainly only nothingness. We cannot interpret this except as meaning that the saint's purpose is to come as near as possible to non-existence, which, for some reason, never clearly explained, he cannot achieve by suicide. Why the saint is to be preferred to a man who is always drunk is not very easy to see. Perhaps Schopenhauer thought the sober moments were bound to be sadly frequent. Schopenhauer's gospel of resignation is not very consistent, and not very sincere. The mystics to whom he appeals believed in contemplation. In the beatific vision, the most profound kind of knowledge was to be achieved, and this kind of knowledge was the supreme good. Ever since Parmenides, the delusive knowledge of appearance was contrasted with another kind of knowledge, not with something of a wholly different kind. Christianity teaches that in knowledge of God standeth our eternal life. But Schopenhauer will have none of this. He agrees that what commonly passes for knowledge belongs to the realm of Maya, but when we pierce the veil, we behold not God, but Satan, the wicked, omnipotent will, perpetually busied in weaving a web of suffering for the torture of its creatures. Terrified by the diabolic vision, the sage cries avaunt and seeks refuge in non-existence. It is an insult to the mystics to claim them as believers in this mythology. And the suggestion that, without achieving complete non-existence, the sage may yet live a life having some value, is not possible to reconcile with Schopenhauer's pessimism. So long as the sage exists, he exists because he retains will, which is evil. He may diminish the quantity of evil by weakening his will, but he can never acquire any positive good. Nor is the doctrine sincere, if we may judge by Schopenhauer's life. He habitually dined well at a good restaurant. He had many trivial love affairs, which were sensual but not passionate. He was exceedingly quarrelsome and unusually avaricious. On one occasion, he was annoyed by an elderly seamstress who was talking to a friend outside the door of his apartment. He threw her downstairs, causing her permanent injury. She obtained a court order compelling him to pay her a certain sum, 15 thalers every quarter as long as she lived. When at last she died, after 20 years, he noted in his account book, Obit annus, abit onus. Footnote. The old woman dies, the burden departs. End of footnote. It is hard to find in his life evidences of any virtue except kindness to animals, which he carried to the point of objecting to vivisection in the interests of science. In all other respects, he was completely selfish. It is difficult to believe that a man who was profoundly convinced of the virtue of asceticism and resignation would never have made any attempt to embody his convictions in his practice. Historically, two things are important about Schopenhauer: his pessimism and his doctrine that will is superior to knowledge. His pessimism made it possible for men to take to philosophy without having to persuade themselves that all evil can be explained away, and in this way, as an antidote, it was useful. From a scientific point of view, optimism and pessimism are alike objectionable. Optimism assumes, or attempts to prove, that the universe exists to please us, and pessimism that it exists to displease us. Scientifically, there is no evidence that it is concerned with us either one way or the other. The belief in either pessimism or optimism is a matter of temperament, not of reason. But the optimistic temperament has been much commoner among Western philosophers. A representative of the opposite party is therefore likely to be useful in bringing forward considerations which would otherwise be overlooked. More important than pessimism was the doctrine of the primacy of the will. It is obvious that this doctrine has no necessary logical connection with pessimism, and those who held it after Schopenhauer frequently found in it a basis for optimism. In one form or another, the doctrine that will is paramount has been held by many modern philosophers, notably Nietzsche, Bergson, James, and Dewey. It has, however, acquired a vogue outside the circles of professional philosophers, and in proportion as will has gone up in the scale, knowledge has gone down. This is, I think, the most notable change that has come over the temper of philosophy in our age. It was prepared by Rousseau and Kant, but was first proclaimed in its purity by Schopenhauer. For this reason, in spite of inconsistency and a certain shallowness, his philosophy has considerable importance as a stage in historical development. Chapter 25. Nietzsche. Nietzsche, 1844 to 1900, regarded himself rightly as the successor of Schopenhauer, to whom, however, he is superior in many ways, particularly in the consistency and coherence of his doctrine. Schopenhauer's Oriental ethic of renunciation seems out of harmony with his metaphysic of the omnipotence of will. In Nietzsche, the will has ethical as well as metaphysical primacy. Nietzsche, though a professor, was a literary rather than an academic philosopher. He invented no new technical theories in ontology or epistemology. His importance is primarily in ethics, and secondarily as an acute historical critic. I shall confine myself almost entirely to his ethics and his criticism of religion, since it was this aspect of his writing that made him influential. His life was simple. His father was a Protestant pastor, and his upbringing was very pious. He was brilliant at the university as a classicist and student of philology, so much so that in 1869, before he had taken his degree, he was offered a professorship of philology at Basel, which he accepted. His health was never good, and after periods of sick leave, he was obliged to retire finally in 1879. After this, he lived in health resorts in Switzerland. In 1888, he became insane and remained so until his death. He had a passionate admiration for Wagner, but quarrelled with him, nominally over Parsifal, which he thought too Christian and too full of renunciation. After the quarrel, he criticised Wagner savagely, and even went so far as to accuse him of being a Jew. His general outlook, however, remained very similar to that of Wagner in The Ring. Nietzsche's Superman is very like Siegfried, except that he knows Greek. This may seem odd, but that is not my fault. Nietzsche was not consciously a romantic. Indeed, he often severely criticizes the romantics. Consciously, his outlook was Hellenic, but with the Orphic component omitted. He admired the pre-Socratics, except Pythagoras. He has a close affinity to Heraclitus. Aristotle's magnanimous man is very like what Nietzsche calls the noble man, but in the main he regards the Greek philosophers from Socrates onwards as inferior to their predecessors. He cannot forgive Socrates for his humble origin. He calls him a roturier and accuses him of corrupting the noble Athenian youth with a democratic moral bias. Plato especially is condemned on account of his taste for edification. Nietzsche, however, obviously does not quite like condemning him, and suggests to excuse him that perhaps he was insincere and only preached virtue as a means of keeping the lower classes in order. He speaks of him on one occasion as a great Cagliostro. He likes Democritus and Epicurus, but his affection for the latter seems somewhat illogical, unless it is interpreted as really an admiration for Lucretius. As might be expected, he has a low opinion of Kant, whom he calls a moral fanatic a la Rousseau. In spite of Nietzsche's criticism of the Romantics, his outlook owes much to them. It is that of aristocratic anarchism, like Byron's, and one is not surprised to find him admiring Byron. He attempts to combine two sets of values which are not easily harmonized. On the one hand, he likes ruthlessness, war, and aristocratic pride. On the other hand, he loves philosophy and literature and the arts, especially music. Historically, these values coexisted in the Renaissance. Pope Julius II, fighting for Bologna and employing Michelangelo, might be taken as the sort of man whom Nietzsche would wish to see in control of governments. It is natural to compare Nietzsche with Machiavelli, in spite of important differences between the two men. As for the differences, Machiavelli was a man of affairs, whose opinions had been formed by close contact with public business and were in harmony with his age. He was not pedantic or systematic, and his philosophy of politics scarcely forms a coherent whole. Nietzsche, on the contrary, was a professor, an essentially bookish man, and a philosopher in conscious opposition to what appeared to be the dominant political and ethical trends of his time. The similarities, however, go deeper. Nietzsche's political philosophy is analogous to that of the Prince, not the Discourses, though it has worked out and applied over a wider field